You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 6th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hello, my friends. How are you?
Hello, hello.
Good. How is everyone doing
good.
This evening?
Not too bad.
Super.
Pretty
so
epic. How about you,
nice.
Steve?
Good. I just tasted the most delicious strawberry I've ever had in my life.
What?
That's
combo.
This is about the guy that we were that came to Nexus.
Yeah, Kevin Folta is a strawberry geneticist, and he sent me a whole bunch of strawberry plants that I've been growing on my deck, and they're producing strawberries now, and they are delicious. Because they're not commercial. You know, they're like heirloom varieties of strawberries, so they have all these kind of really aromatic, strong flavors. Very interesting.
But hold on. Wait. First, these are not available in stores, correct?
No, that's correct. You got to grow them.
But is he developing them to be sold in stores?
Well, that's my understanding, is that he's trying to take the awesome flavor genes out of these strawberries and put them into commercial varieties.
Wait, he wants to genetically modify them?
Oh, yeah.
Could you at least save me one? Like, I want to taste an epic strawberry before I die.
Yeah, come on over.
I make an amazing strawberry shortcake, and I desperately want these for it.
Rebecca, if you're free, you could come down Sunday, because it's my birthday party.
It's funny you should mention it, actually. I just found out that my sister-in-law is working at Music Fest in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where George Robb is, which isn't too far from you guys. And she has tickets to see Weezer on Saturday, and I'm really debating whether or not I want to drive 5 hours.
So then you stop by on the way.
It's not really what you would call on the way.
You swing through. You swing by.
Yeah.
But happy birthday.
Thank you. It's not quite here yet, but it's coming.
Speaking of disastrous days in history.
hey! Woo!
Okay.
This one's kind of a downer. On August 9th, 1945, was the bombing of Nagasaki, the time when the United States dropped its second atomic bomb dropped in a foreign country. 3 days earlier, we had dropped a bomb on Hiroshima. On the 9th, Nagasaki had its turn. And I think it's interesting. Well, first, because, you know, it's obviously a huge moment in human history when I think it's probably the biggest, most violent thing that science has ever brought us, I think, the nuclear bomb. And so I think it's worth noting and remembering. And so this is the 49th anniversary. Also, though, I wanted to bring it up because I just read a really interesting story that I had never seen before. The story about how steel mill workers in another city in Japan, the present-day city of Kita Kyushu, Fukuoka Prefecture. It used to be known as Kokura, I believe. Steel mill workers there heard the airplanes coming with an atomic bomb that they assumed was an atomic bomb, or at least some sort of devastating strike, since the drop on Hiroshima had just occurred a few days prior. Everyone was on edge. And in this particular city, they actually had weapons manufacturing plants. And so they thought that they were probably a target. And in fact, they were. That was the first target that the U.S. was going for on that day. And so these steel mill workers started burning coal tar in order to lay down a smoke screen so that the planes couldn't see their target. And amazingly, it worked. The U.S. planes couldn't find their target. And so they moved to their second option, which was Nagasaki. You know, that's something that I had never known before, that Nagasaki wasn't the initial target. U.S. military documents confirm this. Although in the documents, they just say that there were, you know, weather problems, problems with visibility. But if you look at the weather reports, it was actually a clear day. And so the steel mill workers had held their silence for the past 49 years out of respect to the people who died in Nagasaki, because their actions that day might have saved their own town, but it actually led directly to the deaths of all of these people in Nagasaki. So it didn't seem like something to crow about or to be called a hero over, you know. But I thought that was very interesting. And, you know, obviously it's very complicated where they were an enemy of the United States at the time. And, you know, who do you root for in a situation like this where, you know, obviously, thousands and thousands of casualties are going to be innocent people who have nothing to do with the war. So at the same, you know, you want to kind of cheer these people on for saving their city, but at the same time, there was another city that was just next on the list. So it's kind of depressing, but also I thought very interesting. So yeah, it's the 49th anniversary, dropping of the bomb on Nagasaki.
Yeah, there was cloud cover over Nagasaki actually too, and they actually almost missed their target because just at the last minute there was a break in the clouds and they dropped the bomb and they were like 2 miles off their mark. So it wasn't as devastating as it would have been had it been optimally dropped. They estimate that 40,000 people were killed outright and something like 80,000 ultimately died from the effects of the bomb.
Yeah.
And it was less than Hiroshima, partly because it was a little bit off target, but also Nagasaki was like rimmed by mountains. So it really contained the blast and the radiation a lot more.
Unfortunately, it wasn't like you would think that the death toll would be lower too, because maybe people would have heard about Hiroshima and would have fled the cities. But it seems like the Japanese government didn't really do their work in preparing their civilians for the possibility of these atomic bombings. You know, you could say that for Hiroshima, they probably did not know that the U.S. definitely had an atomic bomb and were prepared to drop it. But for Nagasaki, they did.
Wow. Wasn't there also the belief that, the United States dropped a bomb on Hiroshima, but maybe that's the only bomb they had. And one of the reasons why they dropped it, I remember reading somewhere, was that to show that, we have more than one. We've got two, and maybe we've got 100. Who knows? But I think they only had two.
They had two. Right? Yeah.
Well, they had two, but they had the resources to make a third one by the end of the month, and they had plans to make three more by September.
Yeah, they had the ability to crank these out by that point. This is the Fat Man was the type of bomb. Yeah. If you look at a picture of the bomb, it actually looks like a cartoon bomb. You know, it has that shape to it.
Yeah.
Roundy shape, you know, with the fins on the back. This is a 21 kiloton bomb.
God, that's
and it was the, it was only the third nuclear device that we exploded. The first one
in the desert
was the test. Yeah. And then there was the big boy and then the Fat Man.
Yeah, there were debates on whether or not to do a demonstration showing the Japanese what was capable of, you know, what the U.S. was capable of. But they worried that if they were to do that, that they would lose the element of shock and awe, you know, and also that it might prepare the Japanese to be able to stop the planes in some way or to, you know, to
identify them and take them down before they were able to do their mission. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to talk about this because, as you say, Rebecca, it's such an, you know, it's a terrible thing. Could you imagine 40,000 people being instantly vaporized? I mean, psychologically, the impact of that, but it's also hard from the historical perspective that we have to wrap our minds around the times, you know, this is the end of literally a world war.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be horrible to have to face that decision, you know, because it's not like there was good choices. You know, this was a horrible choice. There were other horrible choices.
Right. I think it was definitely a lose-lose sort of situation. And I find it very interesting to read I'm not a big history buff, but I do find this sort of interesting, like, seeing all of the different perspectives and how a person makes a decision like this and, you know, then how you live with it. I mean, I can't even imagine being one of the people directly involved in flying the planes or, you know, in any other way.
All right. Well, we're going to go on to another sunny news item. Jay, you're going to tell us about the Ebola.
Yeah, I thought it would be good to just give some baseline information here so people understand like what's happening better and understand the virus a little bit better. It's very interesting to read about. I'll tell you that much. There's a lot to it, a lot of details, and it just keeps going on and on. There's a lot of different versions of it and everything. So to start off with this current situation, we have a total of 932 deaths as of today, 8/6/2014. That was a number that I pulled this morning. The current virus has a 57% death rate, and that is well below the 78.5% average death rate over the 14 past outbreaks with the same exact virus.
Well, are you sure it's the same exact? Because I know there are different strains. You know, there's Ebola Zaire, which is one of them, and like some more dangerous than others. Did you come across any of that?
Yeah, I did. Well, actually, Bob, the variation is pretty wide. I think at its worst, one of the varieties is 90%.
Yeah, this outbreak is confirmed to be the Zaire Ebola virus, which is the deadliest strain.
Ebola was first discovered in 1976. It is largely centered in Central and West Africa. And I found that part very interesting. You know, if you just simply ask why is it centralized there? It's because it's living in animals, right? So we're not really 100% sure if, as for example, they think that fruit bats could be one of the reservoirs of the virus.
Oh, I hope not. I'd love now, those guys.
But I read conflicting information saying that the fruit bats may not be a reservoir for the virus, meaning that it lives in them, and when people encounter a fruit bat that has the Ebola virus that isn't being killed by it, they can get the virus from it. But they're not sure. But what we do know is that it can and is spread by coming into physical contact and the exchange of bodily fluids with chimpanzees, gorillas, monkeys, forest antelope, porcupines, and of course, the fruit bat. Now, other than the fruit bat, it was described that all those other animals catch and spread Ebola like humans do, which I found interesting as well. So the Ebola virus belongs to a class of diseases known as viral hemorrhagic fevers.
Hemorrhagic.
It statistically, how could I possibly pronounce everything? Like I'm like 10% correct.
You're doing very well, Jay. So far.
Yeah.
You said Ebola right. You said monkeys right.
Yeah, monkeys. I took time. So
monkeys.
This is a class of fevers. They all have similar traits, and all the different varieties that Bob was saying, they're all in the same class, and they promote bleeding by consuming the parts of your blood that form clots. It's pretty interesting what's physically taking place. And this is why that this virus or these series of viruses have a bleeding problem, is that you actually don't form blood clots the same way anymore. You don't have the ability to do it as a normal person does. So very bad, very powerful way for it to also spread itself. Now listen to this. From the moment of infection, guys, guess how long it takes for the average person to first see symptoms?
It's a 2 to 20 days.
Two days.
Steve?
Days. Yeah, I think I remember like 2 to 21 days.
Well, it averages out, I think, around 5 to 7 days, but it could be anywhere from 2 to 21 days. Now, you could actually have Ebola and be spreading it and not know it for 21 days. That's terrible. That's not good. So that long incubation there could mean, you know, if we aren't careful, you know, it's one of those things that could make it spread a lot easier. The virus, however, does not live in the air. It's not airborne. You really only get it through the transmission of bodily fluids. So if you think about it, it's typically passed from an animal to a human, and it's when humans handle these animals, right? How often do they come in contact with these animals? It's actually pretty often. You know, there's lots of different reasons why people in that part of the world are coming into contact with these animals or the corpses of these animals. And that's another thing about Ebola, is that it could be transferred through a corpse. Like the virus stays around for a long time. It doesn't have to be in living tissue like you would normally think. Absolutely, the drop off happens, but you could have a corpse that's a day old or 2 days old, and you could still catch the virus from it. Now, there's one more thing that I read, and this is actually very shocking and mildly disturbing, is that men's semen can harbor the virus for up to 7 weeks after they've recovered from the actual virus.
Oh my God.
So guys, from the World Health Organization, or WHO, here's a very interesting quote.
WHO?
WHO.
Yes.
They call this virus, by the way, EVD. EVD is a severe acute viral illness often characterized by the sudden onset of fever, intense weakness, muscle pain, headache, and sore throat. This is followed by vomiting, diarrhea, rash, impaired kidney and liver function, and in some cases, both internal and external bleeding. Laboratory findings include low white blood cell and platelet counts and elevated liver enzymes. It sounds a lot like the flu, doesn't it? And especially the first half of that. Even part, you know, the vomiting and diarrhea, that could happen from the flu as well. Survivors can potentially have very bad long-term complications like hepatitis, fatigue, headache, and testicular inflammation, which I thought was also interesting. I had never heard that before. Now, the question, how dangerous is it? This is important because this is where we get into the sensationalization of Ebola. And you know, later on in this topic, I'm going to talk about how people are taking advantage of the fact that it's a scary idea that there's this bad virus going around. Unless you live in one of the outbreak areas, Ebola is simply just not a threat. You're more likely to die from the flu. And statistically, the flu kills way more people than Ebola does.
This is the biggest outbreak that we've ever recorded of Ebola.
Right. But,
you know, 900 plus. Yeah.
The flu is kicking Ebola's ass every winter.
Like, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Samples of Ebola are considered highly dangerous, however, and extreme caution is advised. You could catch it from someone that has a scuff mark on their arm, right? Anything that will produce bodily liquid. Unfortunately, there's no vaccines. Several companies are testing drugs and vaccines right now, of course, and I think this has been a continued effort, but we don't have anything that is legal to use right now. Now, let's move into the second half of this news item where we'll quickly go over. You okay, Ev?
Yeah, you took like a little right-hand turn there suddenly and the car kind of jerked.
Oh, I'm good.
All right. I'm following you.
There's a lot of people that are jumping on the bandwagon for a lot of different reasons. One, people, you know, want to use it as a way to propel their blog. And I'll, you know, shamelessly bring up Mike Adams from Natural News. Our buddy, your buddy, the guy that wants your kids to never put fluoride in their mouth again. And oh, the death threat guy. He recently put an article up on his site called "Infected Ebola Patient Being Flown to Atlanta. Are Health Authorities Risking a U.S. Outbreak?" Donald Trump also was tweeting some very nervous and itchy emails about being worried about bringing the two healthcare providers back to the United States for treatment. The fact of the matter is that under the right care and supervision, it's simply not an issue. And doing moderate research and you know, finding some good sources of information like the WHO website, you know, the World Health Organization,
yeah,
you can easily find out what the real information is. So I'm sorry, Mike. I'm sorry, Donald Trump. No, it's not a bad idea to bring back the U.S. citizens and make sure ensure that they get high level care.
Yeah, I mean, there are two American patients that are being treated in Atlanta in Emory, and the hospital is equipped to deal with this kind of infection. And as you say, it's not airborne. It's actually not that hard to have, you know, precautions to keep this from spreading. Because you just have to have bodily fluid precautions, which, you know, hospitals know how to do that. But this one particularly knows how to deal with this level of infection. It's really nothing to worry about.
And this isn't the first time that Ebola has been in the United States either.
I didn't think it was.
Yeah, a lot of people are claiming that, but it's not true. There was a woman a few years back that had a different strain where the strain wasn't even identified for several weeks after she got better, and she infected a bunch of people and literally no one died from it. And also there are scientists that are studying Ebola every day here in the United States, and they do that with active strains and they know how to take care of it. And so there's no giant outbreaks. No one's dying.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hey, what about the possibility that this thing might mutate and become something other than, for example, airborne as opposed to fluid transmission?
It's always possible, Ev. You know, they just don't know. It could happen. But, you know, right now it is what it is, and we will treat it the way it's behaving. So there's a couple of other quickie things I just want to bring up. One, there's a lot of wacky conspiracy theories. There's people that are saying that with essential oils, you can be cured of Ebola and all that. It's all nonsense. I'm sure a lot of you.
Despicable nonsense.
Yeah, of course. Gosh. I mean, they're taking advantage of people that are scared and everything. And, you know, there's money there, and that's, they will fill in those new empty spaces of places to make money. The conspiracy theories are pretty funny. Some people are claiming that it's a bioweapon. Now, it actually could be a bioweapon, and it could be an effective bioweapon, depending on the particular strain. It's ridiculous to say that it's being spread as a bioweapon. You know, who's deliberately being killed by it? You know, is it, you know, thinning out of the, you know, world population and all that nonsense? But I did want to bring up one interesting thing. Any of you ever play a game called Plague Inc.?
No, but I've seen it played.
No.
Yeah.
Rebecca, yeah, I'm sure you did. Yeah. You and I share a lot of, we like those mid-level games on the iPad.
You gotta get,
right?
Madagascar. That's the key.
That is the key. So very interestingly, this game simulates a lot of different plagues, but you're the plague and you're trying to kill the entire world population. So, there is a, one style of the game is you can play a virus, a real virus, or, you know, even a bioweapon. And it's really cool. Like, you know, it's interesting because you have to mutate your virus and you have to do it, you have to time it correctly and everything. So, if you're interested to see, how a virus like this possibly could spread and how quickly and everything, you know, play the game. It's more fun than accurate, but it's definitely interesting.
Yeah. So I want to point out that there are a lot of homeopaths claiming that homeopathy can cure Ebola with a dilution of rattlesnake venom, because rattlesnake venom causes the same symptoms. So it magically cures Ebola when you dilute it out of existence.
Think of who they're peddling that to, right? Where Ebola is happening in these villages in Africa where these sorts of beliefs, you know, we laugh at it here and say how ridiculous that is. But I'll tell you what, in a place like that, I'll bet you they think that that's a real legitimate thing.
Of course
they
do.
Well, people here think it's a real legitimate thing. The problem is that
even more
there,
so there.
Well, the problem isn't that – I don't think it's necessarily that they're less skeptical there, but I think that the problem is that they're desperate there. And, you know, that's where quacks thrive, is when people are desperate and don't have access to good quality medical care. They reach out for whatever they can. And if they think that this is their only hope, then why wouldn't they? You know, and it is infuriating to see quacks just abusing what they know to be happening in that area.
Definitely. There's a large number of healthcare professionals who are putting their lives at risk to help those in need that are suffering from Ebola right now. Large number of people from around the world are flying to help those in Africa and wherever else the virus is showing up. So first, I'd really like to thank those healthcare providers. It's very dangerous. You know, they're putting their lives at risk to do this. Second, you don't see a busload of homeopaths loaded with potions going to help the infected, you know?
Homeopaths without borders?
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's transition to some brighter news items. Evan, you're going to tell us about the first probe to rendezvous with a comet.
Steve, that's right. It's not only that. It's the first mission designed to both orbit and land on a comet. More on that later. Rosetta is the name of the probe, and it was built and launched by the European Space Agency with the purpose of studying comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko, or Churi for short. Thank goodness they gave it a short name, Churi. And guess what? This morning, August 6, 2014, it entered into orbit, and it became the first man-made spacecraft to orbit a comet. Think about that.
Yeah, cool. It's awesome.
That is freaking incredible. Rosetta Orbiter will remain in close proximity to the icy nucleus as it plunges toward the warmer inner reaches of the sun's domain. And at that time, as it's heading towards the sun, a small lander is going to be released onto the surface of Churi from Rosetta, which is even makes it even cooler than that. And this has been a project in the making for quite a long time. It started in 1993. That's when the International Rosetta Mission was approved as the cornerstone mission of ESA's Horizon 2000 science program. And it was initially scheduled for launch in January of 2003, but it got postponed a bit. There was a failure of a rocket that was going to launch it into space, so they had to wait until they got that sorted out. March of 2004 is when it went up. And here's how it got to the comet. Here's what it needed to do. Okay, and here's what the scientists had to come up with. Rosetta received its first Earth gravity assist in March of 2005, right? So they launch it, they send it out, it comes back to the Earth, and the planet gives it a gravity assist, a push, a boost, into its next set of orbit, in which it received a Mars gravity assist in February of 2007, propelling it back towards the Earth. The Earth gave it its second gravity assist in November of 2007, and then it flew by asteroid Steins in September of 2008, which nudged just enough. It sends it back towards the Earth for a third gravity assist by Earth in November 2009. Right?
What a waste. I hate gravity assists.
And then asteroid Lucietta in July 2010 was its next rendezvous point. And right after that, it went into, you know, space with nothing around it for a while. But it entered hibernation in June 2011. But it had to be awoken. Scientists said, you know, its thing went asleep for almost 3 years. January of 2014, earlier this year, they had to wake it up. And, you know, they weren't really 100% sure it was going to wake up the way, you know, they planned. But it did. It had to make a series of maneuvers, thruster burns, in order to line it up with Churi And that happened in May of 2014. And there have been other burns occurring between then and now over the past couple of months that has put it right into orbit as of today, 80 miles above the comet. This thing could have gone wrong at any one of, I don't know, a dozen or more
times. Yeah, and if it missed, it's done. It had the ability to make minor tweaks to its orbit, but I mean, the dance it did with the Earth, Mars, and these asteroids had to really all work out.
And here are all the historic firsts that this that Rosetta is going to be accomplishing. So, first spacecraft to orbit a comet, the comet's nucleus, I should say, which is happening. It'll be the first spacecraft to fly alongside a comet as it heads towards the inner solar system. Very cool. It'll be the first spacecraft to examine from close proximity how a frozen comet is transformed by the warmth of the sun as it approaches the sun. After its arrival, the Rosetta orbiter will dispatch the robotic lander for the first control touchdown on a comet nucleus. That's very cool. Rosetta's lander instruments will obtain the first images from a comet's surface, right, and make the first analysis right on the surface of a comet to make to see what it's made of. And finally, it'll be the first spacecraft ever to fly close to Jupiter's orbit using solar cells as its main power source. So this little machine, only about 30 meters wide at its full extension with the solar panels, is, you know, the little engine that could, frankly. It's a really, it really is truly an amazing feat. Tip your hats to the scientists and everybody involved in this program. It's just a marvel.
It's already sending us back pictures of Churi, and it's interesting. It's got like two pieces with a thin neck in between. You know, they don't know if this is because it was broken apart at one point, or if this is the merger of two chunks, or maybe it just eroded this way. You know, like every time it gets near the sun, a lot of it evaporates. Maybe this is just what was left. So maybe we'll be able to figure that out by studying it more closely. All right. Thanks, Evan. Let's move on. Bob, talking about the little engine that could, you're going to tell us about NASA's testing of a propellantless drive, which has got quite a buzz going this last week.
All right, guys. So, yeah, apparently NASA has successfully tested a revolutionary spaceship propulsion technology using microwaves that will allow for a reactionless drive. Now, that means it doesn't require any conventional fuel or anything squirted out of the back to push it. Conservation of momentum be damned, apparently. So if you haven't heard about this, welcome back to consciousness. I don't even know really where to start with this. Tons of horrible reporting about this out there, even from Wired and Popular Mechanics. Very, very disappointing. So just a quick timeline overview. In 2000, some goofball named Roger Scheuer claimed that bouncing microwaves inside a tapered metal vessel can propel it with nothing actually leaving the back end of it, as you would think. He claimed that because one end is smaller than the other, more force is pushed against it, moving the device in that direction. And this force is supposedly greater than just the force of the photons hitting the device, as you might think. In 2001, he was given 45,000 quatloos from the British government to test it. But they use quatloos. In 2012, the Chinese did a study on a variation of Scheuer's device and claimed that they measured a tiny unexplained force. And now NASA has tested this idea on another variation of the drive, and they're claiming an even tinier success. So the obvious knee-jerk reaction to the physics-minded for this would be that this is a violation of the conservation of momentum. This conservation of momentum, come on, this is a rock-solid fundamental. It's essentially, momentum always remains constant. You've heard energy is neither created nor destroyed. Well, it's kind of, that's the same with momentum. It can't be created or destroyed, only changed. It relates to Newton's laws of motion. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So a conventional rocket exhaust is different because it cancels out the forward movement of the rocket, and that satisfies the laws of conservation. This does not. So a lot of people are using a really good analogy. They say that this drive is like pushing on your steering wheel to move your car while you're sitting in the car. And that's a very, very good analogy, I think. Physics does not allow for anything like this, and Schomer has claimed that he's using just standard physics. So that just won't happen that way. So the latest news from NASA is what everyone's been crowing about for days. So I'm going to focus on that. So they took it, NASA took a similar engine design called the Kanna drive. That's designed by, some guy named Feta, And so they tested two of those drives. One was working and one was a null test device that was deactivated in some way, and tested them against this incredibly sensitive machine. It's a low thrust torsion pendulum that could sense micronewtons of force. Very, very, very tiny amounts of force. So, and we're not talking apples to oranges here, since the vessel they tested is similar enough to Schaumer's design. He himself said, from what I understand of the NASA and Kinney work, their RF thruster actually operates along similar lines to EM drive. So they are similar enough. They both still create these resonant waves of microwaves inside an asymmetrical vessel to create a thrust with no conventional action reaction. So they are very similar in those very important regards. So when it's all said and done, they claim to have detected an anomalous thrust of 30 to 50 micronewtons, incredibly small. And then the internet went a little crazy. What's wrong with this? What are the huge red flags? So, like I said, there's the apparent violation of the laws of momentum, which I mentioned. This paper that was written about this experiment was not a formal, vetted, and signed-off experimental write-up by NASA. That's not what it was. But that's kind of how it's being portrayed by almost every site that I've gone to. According to the scientist and science blogger, Mika McKinnon, it's a conference paper. Conference papers are totally preliminary. That's what their purpose is. They essentially say to the community, hey, check this shit out. What do you think? Anything we could do to make this better? That's pretty much the attitude. And I think that's a very important distinction compared to a real experimental write-up. Only one other news site has even really mentioned that. So it's kind of frustrating. So also people are throwing around the name NASA, which I think is a little bit misleading. You know, this is a gargantuan agency, close to 20,000 employees. The guys that were important in this, in these experiments, one of them, he believes in faster than light drives, that most people in the community will say that that's just not going to happen. Another guy is on his team, is his teammate. And, so I think to equate, you know, this group of people with NASA, capital letters, with no qualification at all, just doesn't seem right to me. You know, you get the implication that, you know, NASA has signed off on this and they are behind this and this is all NASA. And it's really not quite, it's not really quite like that. So this next point irked me. In their paper, the team says that they won't evaluate the theory behind this device, which is good because the theory sucks. So that's a really good thing to just focus on the experiment. But yet, in the introduction, they throw out this gem. They say, the electric propulsion device is producing a force that is not attributable to classical electromagnetic phenomenon, and therefore, here it comes, is potentially demonstrating an interaction with the quantum vacuum virtual plasma.
There you go.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, boy. So then they mention that. They mention those four words four more times in their paper. They don't go into great detail, but they are throwing that out there. So where did quantum vacuum virtual plasma come from? I don't know. Neither do physicists. It's technobabble. That would sound great on a Star Trek episode, but it's completely unwarranted just to throw that out there. So, I mean, it doesn't take much to realize that what they're trying to get across here is that the engine is pushing against, the virtual particles, quantum virtual particles, which constantly pop into existence. Even in the supposed nothingness of a vacuum, and then they mutually annihilate each other. There's pretty good science behind that, but to throw out this term in this way, I just don't know why they just pull that just right out of their butts. Yeah, this sounds really cool. Let's refer to it this way. So respected physicist Sean Carroll, he agrees with me, of course. He says, there is a quantum vacuum, but it's nothing like a plasma. In particular, it does not have a rest frame, so there's nothing to push against. So you can't use it for propulsion. The whole thing is just nonsense, end quote. The researchers who wrote this paper said they pretty much just pulled it out of their butts. They claim that the engine pushes against the background virtual particles, which suffuse the universe, which would require a rewrite of physics. And they just throw that out there as a possible explanation. Based on what? An incredibly tiny anomalous force that's discussed in a conference paper that has not been reproduced the way they did it. It's very, very irresponsible. So the experiment, another biggie here, the experiment also, they don't seem to control enough for possible sources of error. And that's, you know, especially with such a tiny void, a tiny force, you got it. You got to really control for every little thing. And they did make some effort. I read their paper and they do mention it here and there, but they should, I believe they should have literally devoted whole sections of their paper to just describing how they tried to minimize this. And there's so many ways that, these errors could have creeped in. If you compare the power input to the amount of measured thrust, there's plenty of leftover that could account for these errors. Instead, at the end of the conference paper, they talk about how cool this engine would be, how much money and time that we would save traveling to other planets. And my attitude was like, hey, if you can get around conservation of momentum, there's plenty of other things I'd be talking about rather than how long it's going to take to get to Mars using this device. So another great example of the lack of serious controls is a vacuum test. For, you know, this is designed for a ship that's going to fly in space and you're trying to isolate it as much as you can. They did not even test it in a vacuum. They explicitly say in their paper, testing at vacuum conditions was not possible using our current RF amplifiers. Okay, I understand you had some limitations for whatever reason, but that could, to me, it's a joke almost. It's such a clear potential source of error. You know, any heating of the air around the device, just a little air current could have caused the forces that they tested because they were so, so tiny. It would not take much at all. And to me, that's a big miss right there.
Yeah, this is like the free energy device.
Absolutely.
That have this minuscule excess of energy and claim that that's, you know, some whatever exotic free energy source. But it's so minuscule that that means that even the subtlest experimental error or just unaccounted for force can be responsible for it. So until you actually scale it up, it's just not convincing.
Yeah, they even made mention of they were like 75 miles away from the shore, and they said that the waves hitting the shore, the effect. Well, it doesn't really matter because they said that the effects of that those waves could actually have an impact on experiments 100 miles inland. So, I mean, they're talking about waves miles away that could have an impact. And they also said that even worse than that was just people walking nearby, other experiments happening in other rooms, such little things that you really have to nail down so, so well.
Healthy skepticism is warranted at this time. It's unfortunate, though, that, you know, the NASA name is having such an effect. So many people saying, oh, NASA has verified the Chinese test. Well, first of all, they didn't because the effect was so much tinier.
Which is what you would expect, right? You would expect the NASA or NASA technicians to have much, better equipment in a lot of ways, especially for devices that are designed to test things that go into space. So yeah, it makes sense that it was a lot tighter for these guys.
Well, guys, have you heard about The Hobbit?
Movies.
Good movie, man.
Books.
This is the designation of the alleged new hominin species, Homo floresiensis. This was discovered back in 2003 when a fairly intact skull and some femurs, some thigh bones, were discovered on the island of Flores. They're 15 to 18,000 years old. They're very small stature and actually has a very small cranium as well. But there are signs of modern tool use. I mean like Homo sapiens, like stone tools. Since then, there has been a raging controversy over whether or not this specimen represents a new species, or is it just a unusual specimen of Homo sapiens? You know, could it be a pygmy or diseased, having some developmental disorder? There are essentially dueling teams of scientists going back and forth. I've been following this on Neurologica the whole time, and so I've written about it a number of times, every time some new salvo gets fired in this back and forth.
Steve, haven't there been more than one found, though?
Yeah, there have been a couple of specimens from a couple of other individuals, but none as complete as the one. LB1 is the specimen.
So even with multiple partials, they can't definitively rule out that.
Yeah, but no skulls, you know, so they don't have the key pieces. Yeah, they're just too fragmentary to really settle the debate. That would settle it. If we found a separate specimen, fossils from a different individual that clearly showed the same features, then it's not one anomalous individual, then it's a species, right? That definitive piece of evidence has not been found. So the debate rages. This is back in the news because a team of scientists examining the fossils have determined that the LB1 specimens represent an individual with Down syndrome, with trisomy 21. Now these are the same scientists who have been saying all along that this individual looks like somebody suffering from a developmental disorder. They say that the small brain size, short femurs, and other features are all consistent with the diagnosis, that basically there are multiple lines of anatomical evidence all pointing at Down syndrome or trisomy 21. So, you know, I don't know if this is going to be the final word on this particular controversy. It's interesting, you know, to hear the two teams going back and forth. I don't think so until I hear the other side acquiesce and go, okay, we were wrong, you know, and then everyone agrees. Until that happens and there's still two teams with different conclusions, I think the controversy is going to continue. And of course, the best way to settle this would be to find further specimens. If it turns out that at the same time and place there were, you know, Homo sapiens living on the island and not, you know, Homo floresiensis, that would settle it. Or if we find other specimens that show the same features. And the other thing is, you know, the wrinkle could be that it could be a different hominid species, but this individual may have had some developmental, you know what I mean? It could be a diseased right. version of another specimen, another species. That ironically happened, like they think the first Neanderthal specimen had a disease, like terrible arthritis, and was hunched over. And that sort of created that iconic image of the hunched over caveman.
Oh my God, right?
But and then of course creationists say, well, see, it was just a diseased individual. Yeah, it was a diseased Neanderthal, you know, and obviously we've found many, many specimens since then, you know, including ones that obviously are not diseased. So very interesting, the picture of human evolution has gotten so complicated over the last 20, 30 years as we find more and more specimens. You know, it really was a branching bush. All right, well, let's move on. Bob, I do have a hankering for a quickie with Bob. We haven't had one in a long time.
Yeah. Thank you, Steve. This is your quickie with Bob. So, guys, astronomers have revealed recently that they documented an incredible series of eruptions on Io, moon of Jupiter, last year. Io is the most volcanically active body in the solar system, 25 times more active than the Earth, with more than 400 active volcanoes. They even call it the pizza moon. And actually, it's much prettier than a pizza. Definitely Google image search. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous body. So why is it so active? Probably from tidal heating. The tidal force from Jupiter mostly causes a gravitational gradient in Io's interior that heats it up. Every year or so, there's a huge but brief eruption. Of course, there's smaller ones, but occasionally they have a big one. But they spotted three of these monsters 2 weeks over the course of 2 weeks last August. The third one was the biggest. Now they're all hotter than any volcano on modern Earth, but ancient eruptions on Earth were just as hot as they are on Io, and that's because the heat from radioactive decay back then was much greater than it is now. If you were on Io, what you would have seen was these amazing miles high curtains of lava erupting from these cracks, these very long cracks in the crust on Io. They were producing, you'd see cubic miles of lava being released, spreading over hundreds of square miles on the surface. Rebecca, remember missing Nexus that time because of that Iceland volcano?
How could I forget?
Yes, well, these volcanoes were 10,000 times bigger than that. 10,000 times bigger than that one. It was a hell of a show, and I'm sorry that we didn't have any probes in orbit when they went off. But it was cool. So this has been your quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too.
Thanks, Bob.
That was Bob.
Well, Evan.
Thanks, Steve. I'll play for you right now. Last week's Who's That Noisy? Who is this voice?
I went nuts. I don't know what happened. I just lost it, and I just became a poor actor in New York from like being like a star student at MIT. I don't know. You tell me. I just. Crazy, I suppose. Swedish. I don't know how to explain it.
MIT to acting.
MIT to acting. He also mentioned, Sweden in there. And that could only be one person, right, Bob?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, it can only be.
Dolph Lundgren.
Yes, Dolph Lundgren, I must break you. Swedish actor, director too, martial artist. Belongs to a generation of film actors who epitomize the action heroes action hero stereotype. You know, the Sylvester Stallones, Chuck Norris's, Arnold Schwarzenegger's, and all those sorts of people. But, you know, before he had a career in the movies and stuff, he was actually, you know, very well educated. He received a degree in chemistry from Washington State University in 1976, a degree in chemical engineering from the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm in the early 80s, and then a master's degree in chemical engineering from the University of Sydney in Australia in 1982. And he was at MIT for a very short time before he broke away, went to New York, and decided to get into acting. And lots of correct answers, mostly from Swedish people. You'd be surprised at how many Swedish people wrote in. John Lann from the message boards is this week's winner. Congratulations. You're now in the drawing. At the end of the year, we're going to pull a name of all the winners of Who's That Noisy, and the grand prize winner is going to join us to play a round of science or fiction in early 2015. So congratulations, John.
And what do you got for this week?
Here's a tune. Okay. You don't have to identify the tune, but this week's noisy is going to be about is you have to identify the instrument that is creating this sound. So let's see if you can figure this one out. Here we go. So there it is. And again, you know, not looking for the tune. We're looking to find out exactly what instrument produced that noise. So go ahead and give it your best guess. Send us your email. Who's That Noisy Guesses? Go to WTN@theskepticsguide.org, or much like John Land from last week, go to our message boards, sguforums.com. Look for the sub thread there called Who's That Noisy episode 474 and give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to some emails. Have you guys ever heard of herxing?
Yes, uh-oh. Miley Cyrus did it at the Kids Musical Award or something.
Right, that's right, Evan. All right, now, let's read this email. This email comes from Jeremy in New York City. And Jeremy writes, what can you guys tell me about herxing, a.k.a. Jarisch-Herxheimer reaction? As far as I can make it out, it is a minor footnote of medical science, but to the chronic Lyme crowd, it is a crucial and magical diagnostic tool, better than any serological test. According to Wikipedia, reaction commonly occurs within 2 hours of drug administration, but is usually self-limiting. In chronic Lyme land, though, herxing goes on for days, weeks, months, years. It waxes and wanes. It can produce a wide variety of symptoms and often resembles the throes of religious ecstasy. Most dubious chronic Lyme sufferers are instructed to gauge their own health in response to treatment with the bizarro yardstick, where the sicker you feel, the better you're getting. Seems like a sketchy racket to me. Kindly disinfect with sunlight. Thanks. So, the Herxheimer reaction is legitimate. Essentially, what happens is if you take a bactericidal antibiotic, an antibiotic that doesn't just keep bacteria from reproducing or growing, but one that actually kills them, and you have an infection, especially a serious infection with a bacteria that has an endotoxin, that you kill so much of the bacteria so quickly, they dump all of their endotoxin into your blood and you get an acute reaction. So it's something that we look out for. Like if somebody is very sick with a bacterial infection, you give them, you know, big gun antibiotics, they might get sicker over the course of, you know, the next few hours or day due to the Herxheimer reaction.
So could it kill them?
Yeah. I mean, if you're like septic, it could push you over the edge. Yeah. That's what they're talking about. And you can get a Herxheimer reaction with Lyme, but the Lyme spirochete. In fact, it was initially described for syphilis, which is another spirochete. You know, so it's related to Lyme disease. But the way, if you look up herxing or you look up, you know, Herxheimer reaction and Lyme disease on the internet, most of the sources you're going to find are dubious. Essentially what they're doing is this, in my opinion. You know, chronic Lyme, meaning that you have a chronic active or symptomatic Lyme infection that survives beyond treatment with what, mainstream physicians consider to be full or definitive antibiotic therapy. That's considered chronic Lyme. Now, chronic Lyme has never been demonstrated to exist. Some people can have chronic symptoms following Lyme. That's called post-Lyme syndrome. And of course, if it's untreated, you could have Lyme until you get treated. And people can get recurrent Lyme. You can get infected again. But there are those who think that they have symptoms of Lyme. They get treated. They feel better for a little while. Then the symptoms come back. And it's still the same Lyme infection that's ongoing, even though they're getting treated multiple times, even with IV antibiotics that really should wipe out the infection. Not by coincidence. You know, a lot of these patients also feel that they have seronegative Lyme and that they have atypical Lyme. See a pattern here? So it's a lot of special pleading. You know, they think they have seronegative, atypical, treatment-resistant Lyme. Or, alternatively, they could not have Lyme. You know, that would be, I think, the simpler explanation. They have something else. In any case, there have been lots of studies, you know, without going into all the background on that, in my opinion, there have been studies which clearly show that people who think that they have chronic Lyme disease don't. And even if you know, if you treat them with antibiotics versus placebo, that there's no difference. So by adding the whole herxing notion, essentially what that means is if they get treated for their alleged chronic Lyme and they feel better, that's because they're treating the Lyme disease. And if they feel worse, that's because they're treating the Lyme disease and they're having a Herxheimer reaction. So no matter what happens after treatment, they could claim that that is evidence that they have Lyme disease. You know, they're using it in order to, as a sort of a special pleading type of argument to say no matter what happens, it's consistent with them having Lyme. And of course, they stretch the definition. If you read the websites where they describe it, I mean, they're vague, nonspecific, chronic symptoms. You know, they're not like the typical acute symptoms of the Herxheimer reaction that have been clearly described. So you also broaden the definition of what it could be. So basically anything that happens, and they could say that's evidence of having Lyme disease.
We're sitting here now with Dr. Carl Kruszyniski.
Pretty close.
Pretty close. Affectionately known as Dr. Carl in Australia and the world over, but mostly in Australia. That's where you're from.
I'm not the world over. I, in fact, in America.
Yeah.
I have. And I'm going to sue Tam for this.
Yeah.
I have been going through celebrity decompression.
Mm-hmm.
People are not coming up telling me how wonderful I am.
In the
United States. And I blame Tam for this. I'm going to get an expensive lawyer. They are in such big trouble.
Well, I got to tell you,
I was just saying that before I really interrupted, so I'm not that well known.
Richard told us how famous you are.
Micro famous.
And I didn't know who you were when we first talked. I knew that you were Richard's friend. I didn't know it was the famous guy.
Best friend forever. Yeah,
that's
you.
Right.
And you're a super nice guy and you're real. And that's more important than all the fame.
You're not Richard's fictitious friend.
That's it.
Yes.
No, you don't have. I didn't detect the ego. I didn't detect all the other things that sometimes come.
I had the advantage
like
of
all
working
my other
in jobs. Luckily, I had the advantage of working in jobs where people are rude to you. I was a taxi driver for 15 years, and so I think everybody should work in jobs where people are rude to them, so that when they become rich and famous or micro famous, they won't be rude to people who work in jobs where people are rude to them.
Right. So I should also say that we're sitting here with Richard Saunders.
Hello,
Richard,
again.
Welcome
Hi.
Back.
Thank
Always
you.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. So we should say that, Dr. Carl, what you're famous for is being a beloved science communicator. You are Australia's Carl Sagan. Is that fair?
Bill Nye. I
not
Bill
quite.
Nye,
Australia's
yeah.
Bill Nye.
Yeah.
Mostly I answer questions. And so on a typical supermarket shop, where I go up and down every aisle looking for the new products and say yes to anything my daughters want, I'll get two people coming up to me on average, and they'll say, thank you, Dr. Carl, for everything you've done on radio. Because what I do is I mainly do talkback radio, where people ring in and ask questions and I try to answer them. And they'll say, thank you for what you've done, and as a result I have now decided to become a chippy. Is that an American word?
No. What is that?
Carpenter.
Yeah. They make
wood
chips.
I've become
a chippy.
Wood chips.
Chippy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chippy.
Jesus was a carpenter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Which is true. Yes.
He was a hippie chippy.
Yeah. So I'll become a chippy or start a nursing degree or finish off my school certificate or do my PhD.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what it is about answering questions on radio that makes people change their careers into something where they're using more of their brain and earning more money.
Yeah.
So that's different from what Carl Sagan did. He got difficult and awe-inspiring concepts and made them understandable. Mm.
Yeah. Right,
they
right.
were glorious. So, and he was much deeper than I was. Yeah. I'm shallow. So I've got...
Practical.
Yeah, I can repair an engine, kind of. So I've got degrees in physics and maths and engineering and medicine and surgery, but I'm not deep at any of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've forgotten so much. So Jack of all trades,
master of none.
No, I think it's fair to say master of none. I can get by, but I'm not a master of anything. I'm just a generalist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But and you were trained as a medical physician to some degree.
I worked at the kids' hospital as a medical doctor
yeah.
for a couple of years, but I was working 40 hours a week and doing 100 hours a week unpaid overtime. Mm-hmm. And I had a child, and I suddenly thought, hang on, I don't see my child. And so I decided I would then get away from society and just stop being a doctor. But then the phone kept on ringing, and so then I decided, well, I'll just build up a four-wheel drive and go into the Australian Outback. And so I spent 2 years going through the Australian Outback, away from all forms of communication.
You went on a walkabout?
No, I had a four-wheel drive truck.
Drive about.
Yeah. My biggest trip was starting off in the middle of Australia. It took a while before I got to be good enough to do this. And I went west for 1,000 kilometres, then turned right and went north for 1,000 kilometres. And it took me a month to do 1,000 kilometres. And in that month, we saw only one other group of travellers in a whole month.
Wow.
And we had to carry all of our own fuel for a month, 160 gallons. Mm-hmm. And we drank 1.5 tons of water. We drank 50 litres of water a day, and the temperature was 48. What's
Whoa.
That in?
48 Celsius.
Yeah,
what that's, hot. That's hot.
Yeah. It was 120 Fahrenheit. In the daytime, yeah. and it dropped down to a nice, comfortable 37 around 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, boy. Oh,
cool.
Yeah.
Hope you brought a
and
sweat.
So for a month, we didn't see anybody except that one group of travellers who were heading in the same direction.
What kind of food were you eating?
What we could carry. So it was basically dried food, and we navigated our way to a well every second or third night. And it didn't matter whether it was muddy or dirty or had a dead bird or a headless lizard, we drank it. We tried the chlorine trick, but the girls decided that it just tasted too bad. And luckily the Australian Army had just discovered that if you add totally synthetic cordial to water, none of this natural crap, totally synthetic, so a few certain brands, I've got the paper, it would kill the bacteria that cause food poisoning of many different types.
So it was oil, you said?
Wow. Or
food cordial? What do you call food cordial?
What's
the American cordial?
I don't know.
It's a small amount of liquid that's very concentrated.
Concentrated
and
liquid.
And then you what add water to it. It's brightly coloured red or orange or green.
Oh, yeah. That's
what do you call it?
I've seen it. People buy it. It's a treatment for water.
This is a drink.
This is a drink you have for parties.
You buy a big bottle and you pour this much into a glass and you fill the rest with water.
Oh, I
thought it comes in lime and raspberry and
Kool-Aid.
Kool-Aid. Is that what it is?
Yes.
Let's all drink the Kool-Aid.
Drinky, colored drink.
Right.
Kool-Aid? So Kool-Aid kills bacteria?
Only if it's totally synthetic. None of this natural crap.
Okay.
That natural stuff will kill
you. So what flavor Kool-Aid was it?
We just got a bunch.
Yeah, it's all right.
And so we went away. I had a backup plan as well in case my wife, who was breastfeeding, died. Because we took our daughter through when she was 6 weeks old. So we waited and got her vaccinated and then just headed off by ourselves for a month.
Wow.
And the backup plan was that if she died, I had packed away a whole bunch of food packets of, add water to them and you get a certain milk. For feeding the baby.
Right.
And if the truck had caught on fire, the backup plan to that was that I had, underneath the truck, I had stashed some weapons so that I could, just hand axes and stuff, so I'd kill some animals. And I did some reading that the Australian Aborigines, when this actually happened to them, when they were travelling through the western deserts of Australia, would get an animal and kill it and get the brain and add an equal amount of water. And that made a pretty damn good breast milk substitute.
Oh, wow. Mm. Interesting.
It's good to know things.
So that
just
was how
in
long?
Case,
one,
right?
That was 1 month of travel, you're saying?
Well, that was we would go away for 3 months at a time and then come back for 3 months and go away for 3 months, and we did this for 2 years.
So you actually enjoyed the trips?
Oh, it was fantastic.
You're a survivor. You're a survivor.
No, because to be a survivor, you've got to be prepared to eat the person next to you
and
tell back things about them.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, well, we didn't do that. So we were always traveling and loving it. And one thing I loved especially was a really weird thing, the silence. You don't get that silence anywhere else in the world. So on one occasion we'd park near a lagoon, a well, and there was a small tiny lagoon which sometimes had water and didn't, some it did. We parked about 0.5 kilometre away because we didn't want to upset the birds. because they would come in and fly. Mm-hmm. And we heard this noise, sort of flabbity, 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 swoosh, 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 flabbity, flabbity, swoosh, swoosh, swoosh. We thought, what the heck is that? And it was the sound of air going through the feathers of migrating ducks that we could hear from half a kilometre away.
Whoa. So they were flying, or there was just...
They were coming into land, okay. And we could hear the whistling of the air going through their feathers from half a kilometre away because it was dead quiet.
Yeah.
Now, suppose you get the noise-cancelling headphones, right? You put on noise-cancelling headphones anywhere in the world, and you put them on, and then you switch on the noise-cancelling function, and then suddenly the outside world goes away. And then you take off the headphones, and then suddenly you can hear this world around you.
Yeah.
But you don't hear it normally. It's like putting on your socks first thing in the morning. You put the socks on and you can feel them for about a second, then suddenly you don't hear it. We live in a minimum of 30 dB of sound. So the range is 0, 30, 8 is long-term damage, and then 120 is, you know, Rolling Stones 747 taking off, right. Ear damage, wow. Immediately. So we've got a narrow dynamic range from about 30 to 80, but we had from 0
yeah.
to 80. Sometimes you thought we could hear your own heartbeat. It was so quiet. There was just no noise. You don't get on the ocean.
Mm.
We were in a part of the world where, and this was astonishing, because I went and did a talk about this in India, because the Indian government invited me to do a triumphal tour of India to the various schools and high schools and universities. And in a part of India where they had 200 million people, we had 200.
Yeah.
They couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe how empty Australia was.
Of course.
Smaller than the population of
Mumbai. That's amazing. What a crazy comparison.
Yeah. It is. Yeah, have you been to India?
No.
Some years ago, I went to New Delhi for a rationalist conference, maybe 10 years ago or so. And it's really walking around certain areas of New Delhi and just seeing what do you call it? A mass of humanity.
Everywhere. They're sleeping under the trucks at night.
It's astonishing.
We came out of the airport the first time at Kolkata, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and we're walking through the broken concrete of a small parking lot, and there's a four-year-old girl awake at 2 o'clock in the morning holding, I guess, her deliberately crippled one-year-old sister and begging.
Oh, my gosh.
And I cried.
Yeah.
She should be in bed wearing pink stuff and fairy tale stuff, not begging at 2 o'clock in the morning.
That is terrible.
It's incredible. Terrible. It's a shock to the system.
It is a shock to the system.
Everybody should go to India at least once.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's amazing. You've got 20 religions, 20 languages, and they're not having a war with each other.
Yeah.
Amazing country. I love that fact that they're not having a civil war.
So are there any raging scientific controversies in Australia that you deal with that people ask you a lot about? Like, in the U.S., we have, like, global warming and GMO foods.
But that can't be a control. Look, in 1977, Munich Re, we're talking about global warming.
Yeah.
Munich Re, the world's largest insurance company, had already factored global warming into their insurance premiums.
Is that right?
Right. They wrote an article about it recently in The Guardian. In 1980, I did my first radio story about it, saying, might be real, might not enough data to tell to convince the scientists. In 1985, in my first book, I said the same thing. And in 1988, the scientists stood up and said, global warming is real, we cause it, it's going to be bad. Now, okay, the climate scientist said it. Now, if you happen to have a friend with a kid and the kid's got chronic myeloid leukemia or something, and the doctor says, well, I think we should use cyclophosphamide, you don't say, that's hippie bullcrap. We should be using 5-thiouracil. You're wrong. Or if a metallurgist says, the way you turn iron into steel is you add a few percentage points of carbon. Or if an electrical engineer says, well, to plot out the electrical grid to feed alternating electricity to houses, I need to use the square root of -1. You don't disagree with them. Why is it that it's only global warming that has a fake controversy set up about it? Nobody worries about the fact that the dinosaurs died out 65 million years ago, except for 40% of Americans and 46% of Australians. But apart from that, so why is it? And then you can apply your own conspiracy theory.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, we talk about these topics all the time, and we haven't really talked about, like, why is there a problem with global warming? Why is there a problem with GMO? I think it just kind of gets popularized through one channel. Somebody popularizes it. Some big name, or somehow it just gets into the social consciousness, and it spreads. I don't think there's like a deliberate meaning. I don't think it
is deliberate.
Do you think so? There was a deliberate campaign.
Read the book
campaign?
By Naomi Oreskes, N-A-O-M-I Oreskes, O-R-E-S-K-E-S, called The Merchants of Doubt. And she talks, she makes a nice analogy with tobacco. Mm-hmm. Mm. All you have to do is say doubt. Okay, Professor Novella says that there's a 94% chance that if you smoke so many cigarettes, you will have lung cancer. But Professor Saunders says it's a 93%, 92%. Well, they're disagreeing with each other. Yes. Therefore, they're both wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
All you have to do is throw the doubt. And so there's been this deliberate...
Who did it? Like
disinformation... the George C. Marshall Institute, Washington, D.C. Huh. The history is well and carefully outlaid. It's a well-funded campaign to stop the people who are making money out of business as usual from suffering. And it will change. We will change.
You're a good man. You're a good man.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is not true. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yep.
We are themeless this week, just three regular news items. Item number one. Researchers report that they were able to change the color of a butterfly population's wings from brown to violet in just six generations of selection. Item number two, a new study finds that asking people a single question to rate themselves on a 7-point narcissism scale is as reliable and valid as longer narcissism surveys consisting of 40 or more questions. And item number three, scientists have developed a technique for bending sound waves along a curved path in open air without the need for any special medium. Bob, go first.
Okay, so changing butterfly population wings brown to violet, just six generations. Yeah, that's leaping out at me for that one. I'll tentatively say okay. So the narcissism one, one question? Well, that doesn't sound right. As much as 40. I don't know if I'm buying that one. Let's see this last one here. Bending sound waves. I'm not sure how they would pull that off, but that's cool. I really hope that one is true. Oh, man. All right, I'm gonna say this, the narcissism one is rubbing me the most wrong. One question. Jeez. Okay, I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
The one about the changing of the butterflies. Yeah, I see no reason why that they wouldn't be able to make a color change in seven generations. I mean, sure, six generations. I mean, sure, it doesn't seem like that many, but that just seems perfectly cromulent to me. The one about the narcissist one. So I guess the one question is, do you wear a t-shirt that says I'm awesome on it? And then there you go.
Yeah, just so you, I know that's a joke, Jay, but I just want to make sure you're clear on it. The question is, how would you rate yourself on a narcissism scale, right? That's the question.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, wait. Do you actually say that?
Oh, I didn't pick up on that either. Okay. Mm.
They ask him a single question, comma, to rate themselves on a 7-point narcissism scale. That's the question.
Oh, okay. That's funny. I didn't read it as clearly as you just restated it. I honestly do not believe that a narcissist would think that they're a narcissist. I think that's part of the narcissism. So I'm going to tentatively flag that one as the fake. This final one about sound traveling along a curved path. I think that this is absolutely possible. Steve's saying no special medium, but you know, I would imagine that they have some way of influencing the sound waves to change their direction subtly. This one about the narcissist is really rubbing me the wrong way, so I'm going to say that one's the fake.
Okay, Evan?
I don't have a problem with the butterfly one. Six generations does seem like a small amount. They just got the right controls. They figured out exactly what genes to whatever they did with the genes to make to make it happen. And that's not surprising. The narcissism question, to rate yourself on a 7-point narcissism scale. It's reliable as one consisting of 40 or more questions. I guess I'm not surprised that perhaps the results turned out the way they did. It seems counterintuitive. And then the last one, a technique for bending sound waves along a curved path in open air. I don't No, I don't see a way that this would have happened. I'm tempted to think that this is the fiction. I'm going to say the narcissism one is the fiction.
And Rebecca.
That was the one that I was immediately like, oh, well, that's obviously true. I don't understand why you guys don't think that that one is true.
What, the narcissist like, one?
Yeah, because that makes total sense to me.
Because they wouldn't rate themselves high. You know, think about it. Oh, I can't talk right now. Sorry.
Narcissism, it's, you know, so it's egoism. It's somebody who's just really focused on themselves and believes that they're better than everyone else. So if you think you're better than everyone else, generally, you also don't think that that's irrational. And so you wouldn't be inclined to lie about it. So I just feel like it's kind of like asking like a racist if they're better. Like, do you think white people are better than black people? And if they say yes, then they're a racist. Like, these are people who, if you ask them the right question, they will tell you about themselves. And I think that this narcissism thing is in that same category. I think that just as like, are you a narcissist? Like, yeah, of course I am. I'm better than everyone else. So obviously I like myself better than other people. Like that makes sense to me. And the butterfly wings one makes sense too. Six generations seems like more than enough time. Like brown to violet is a fairly subtle shift, really, if you think about it. So six generations, yeah, seems like more than enough time to get that done. So that just leaves the sound waves one. I don't know anything about this item except for that I know that, you know, we can bend sound waves in interesting ways. And that's how we can do weird things with sound waves, I think, like ultrasounds. I think those are bent somehow. I don't know. I don't know much about it, but I mean, just by process of elimination, I think that one's the fiction.
All right. So you all agree with number one, researchers report they were able to change the color of a butterfly population's wings from brown to violet in just six generations of selection. You guys all think this one is science. And this one is science.
You didn't pause and say something before you revealed it to be.
I have to be unpredictable. Okay. This study was done at Yale University. They did it using a butterfly called the Bicyclus. This butterfly is normally brown, but the reason they decided to try to make it violet is because there are related species that are violet. So this is kind of cheating. So they thought that the potential might be there, you know, the genetic potential that maybe on more than one occasion it independently evolved the violet color. So they tried to do it, and they were able to do it in just six generations. They were able to get the wings to look violet. So the change was in the thickness of the scales on its wings, and the change in thickness resulted in the color change from brown to violet. But they were surprised at how quickly they were able to do it. So that indicates that there was the potential for that to be there in the first place. And then that's something that is seen in evolution quite a bit, that things that are easy to evolve happen over and over again. All right, let's move on to number two. A new study finds that asking people a single question to rate themselves on a 7-point narcissism scale is as reliable and valid as longer narcissism surveys consisting of 40 or more questions. Rebecca thinks this one is science. The rest of you think this one is the fiction. And this one is... So, you know, I took the test.
There, that's what I've been waiting for.
It didn't take very long. It was one question.
And how awesome are you?
So I said, go to the website. It says, how would you rate yourself on how narcissistic are you from 1 to 7? I said, okay, well, whatever. I'll say 4 because it's right in the middle. Maybe I'm average.
Cop out.
But 80% of people designated less than 4, thought they were lower on the scale than 4. This one is, I'm sorry, Rebecca, I really do feel bad about this one. This one is the fiction.
Yay.
Wow.
Even though it's almost true, but it's not quite true. So it's not as reliable or valid. It's not as reliable a test. But it was better than they thought it was going to be. It does give you some information about how narcissistic the individual is. And you're both right. Jay and Rebecca are both right about would a narcissist be honest on this question? Well, it actually depends on the type of narcissist. there are some types of narcissists, which as exactly as Rebecca described, who like, yeah, I'm a narcissist because I'm wonderful. You know, they don't see any contradiction there. But others, those that are more concerned about how other people perceive them might lie on this test in order to present what they think is a better image of themselves. So they might conceal their narcissism. But, yeah, the results actually were, they say it's a good down and dirty test. You know, this single question narcissism scale. And that if you do, in situations where you can't do the more thorough 40 question narcissism survey, then you can substitute this single question test.
What situations would those be?
If you're doing a survey over cell phones, they said, you know.
It just seems like I can't think of a lot of situations where there's like an emergency where you need to know somebody's a narcissist.
Well, so like they said, for example, it's the venue in which you're taking this information. They said that, you know, people in a situation where people are not likely to maintain their attention and concentration through 40 questions, you're not likely to keep them and have them complete the survey. Mm-hmm. But they're very likely to answer one question. You know, then you're some information is better than no information or better than incomplete information. So they said, you know, it's an option that you can use, but if you can use the longer surveys, you should, because the longer surveys are more reliable. It was more true than you might have thought.
Right.
But yeah, I had to make it exaggerated to make it the fiction. All right. And number three, scientists have developed a technique for bending sound waves along a curved path in open air without the need for any special medium. This one is science. This one's cool. This is researchers with the U.S. Department of Energy, Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. They've created what are called acoustic bottles. They said they could generate acoustic bottles in open air that could bend the path of sound waves along prescribed convex trajectories. The sound waves will travel sort of around the bottle, creating, like, they'll curve a path around this sort of pressure bottle that they create. And it's almost like a donut. So there's a hole in the middle.
Cool.
Yeah. Mm. And they say that this could have potential applications. There's the ability to control sound waves in this way, basically to get it to go around corners. This could be very useful for medical ultrasound imaging, for example, or even therapeutic applications. So yeah, it's pretty neat. All right. So good work, guys.
Yeah. Good job.
Rebecca, you were right. You were wrong for the right reason. You actually were more right than they were, but it got you into trouble.
That's cold comfort.
Yeah. All right, Jay, do you have a quote for us?
Yes, this is awesome. I got an email very recently from a listener named Sebastian Beckwatt. Sebastian is from Toronto, Canada. He sent me a link to one of my favorite songs, actually. This is a Tom Waits song called Step Right Up. And in this song, Tom Waits very cleverly talks about, all the things that Barkers would say to someone to sell them something, like a used car salesman or whatever. And it's just a really great, you know, if you know anything about Tom Waits' music, every song is different. And he just caught a vibe in this song that is so epic. So the lyric is, "You got it, buddy. The large print giveth and the small print taketh away. Step right up."
Yeah. That's funny.
So I highly recommend that you listen to Tom Waits. One of his albums I love the most is Swordfish Trombone. Mm-hmm. Just a collection of the strangest, mm-hmm. most interesting songs you could possibly imagine. Tom Waits!
All right, thanks, Jay.
You know, we're going to be in Atlanta for Dragon Con coming up. If you happen to be in Atlanta on Thursday night before Dragon Con, please go to the Atlanta Star Party. You can find out information at atlantastarparty.com. I've been a number of years. It's in honor of an amazing astronomer named Jeff Bedkeff. And proceeds go to the Alzheimer's Foundation of America, American Cancer Society, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, and Cosmo Quest. So it's going to be August 28th, 2014. You can buy tickets at atlantastarparty.com. And there's always a bunch of awesome astronomers there and stargazing and food and wine and the whole dealy. Check it out.
And yeah, so we're doing a live show Saturday night at 7 o'clock at Dragon Con, and we'll be doing a private recording
The details on that we're still working out, so we will let you know as soon as we get that squared away. All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining me again this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.
Everyone's a winner, bargains galore. That's right, you two can be the proud owner. The quality goes in before the name goes on. One-tenth of a dollar, one-tenth of a dollar. We got service after the sale. How about perfume? We got perfume. How about an engagement ring? Some for the little lady, some for the little lady, some for the little lady. $3-4. We got a year-end clearance, we got a white sale, and a smoke-damaged furniture, you can drive it away today. Act now, and receive as our gift to you. They come in all colors, one size fits all. No muss, no fuss, no spills, you tired of kitchen drudgery, everything must go. Going out of business, going out of business, going out of business sale. 50% off original retail price, skip the...